Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable. Welcome to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this Wednesday morning. It is the 13th of September and a very nice day, and we thank you for spending time with us this morning. Let me introduce our panel to you, and then we'll get started with our discussion for the day. A lot to talk about, as there always is. Joining us this morning, we have our communications consultant, Teresa Bourgeois. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. I'm so excited. Big wins last night.
Yeah, so we'll talk about that. It was primary day, and somebody is just glowing over in the corner.
Right.
They're just positively glowing.
Well, she's glowing about different wins.
She's talking about the Red Sox.
No, I know.
I have two Child Health Plus.
Yeah. Huh? Well, so our political consultant, Libby Post, works with candidates, and your candidates won last night.
Yes, they did. I had Holly Trexler run for Albany City Court Judge. It was a hard fought race. It was a field of seven for three open slots. City Court, heavily contested. But she came in second with over 5,000 votes. It was like a 200-vote difference between her and John Riley, she was an incumbent. Riley's an incumbent. Helena Heath also won last night. Everyone expected Jim Long to take a spot, but that didn't happen for him. This is the second time he's lost. And then out in New Scotland, where Mike Mackey was tapped as Supreme Court Justice last year, the party appointed Daryl Duncan, who was the highway superintendent, and a woman named Vicky Plotsky decided, after November, she heard the call with a lot of women to run. She ran a spirited Democratic primary. She cleaned his clock. It was an amazing, she's got like 70% of the vote, something to that effect. And it was 3-1. And then she won in the I line, the independence line, write-in. So I'm a very happy camper this morning.
Well, good for you. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Very nice. Do you get a bonus after all that?
I don't work that
way. Okay, all right.
Just pay my bills and I'm happy.
Okay. That's very good. We're also thrilled that Frankie Bailey is back with us. She's been on our program before, but we're delighted to have her back. University at Albany School of Criminal Justice professor. Frankie Bailey, good morning. Thank you
good
very
morning.
Much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Very nice to have you.
Looking
forward to it. I always feel when I read you, but I also have to say that you're a celebrated mystery author.
I am a mystery author. I didn't know about celebrated.
Well, I celebrate whenever your books come out. You're really good stuff.
Thank you.
And the new novel is you're finishing, right?
Yeah, I'm working on a historical thriller.
Oh, that's great. Well, that's really exciting. So, welcome. Thank you very much for being here. We appreciate you being here. All right, let's go. Alan is not with us. He is on vacation. So people have been asking where Alan is, and we just want you to know that he is safe and sound, and he is away, and we'll be back middle of next week. So there you go. We look forward, and we'll hold down the fort till he comes home.
Much deserved respite.
Absolutely. Talked to him last night. Seems to be doing very well. So, all right. Let's go with what is happening in the world. And, there's a lot happening in the world. So we'll talk about that. And here we go. We begin with... let me bring up my stories, which suddenly I can't find. And I apologize for this. Give me 2 seconds. There we go. We want to talk about, we'll start with the census and what we know now about quality, because I think these numbers are interesting, and I also think of how they are being talked about is interesting. The U.S. middle class incomes reached highest ever levels in 2016, according to the Census Bureau. The incomes of middle class Americans rose last year to the highest level ever recorded by the Census Bureau as poverty declined and the scars of the past decade's Great Recession seemed to finally fade. Yet, the census report also points to the sources of deeper anxieties among American workers and underscores threats to continued economic progress. Inequality remains high, with the top fifth of earners taking home more than half of all overall income, a record. And yawning racial disparities remain, with the median African-American household earning only 34 $39,490 compared with more than $65,000 for whites and over $81,000 for Asians. Economists and policy experts wonder whether the gains will continue. The median income has surged since 2014 because millions more Americans found full-time jobs, but there is little evidence that employers are rushing to offer raises to those who already are employed. Without more wage gains, momentum could slow. And of course, even though those gains were seen in 2014, President Trump is taking credit for it. I just thought I would slip that in. Sorry.
Yeah, he had nothing to do with this. Absolutely nothing. This was all the foresight and hard work and economic recovery of President Obama. People are starting to feel the benefits of it. But with the looming tax cuts, we might go right back to where we were in 2007 and 2008, if we're not careful.
Looking at the gap, though, between that inequality and of going for basically white and Asian, which is very high, and then all the sort of the average at 54,000, and then taking just a huge dip down to 37,000 for the average Hispanic worker and 35,000 for the average black worker. That gap from 35 to 55 is that's quite a chasm, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think that's the disturbing part, that African Americans are always at the bottom. So these numbers don't mean a lot if you're underemployed or if you're struggling to get along. And that's always the story, that African Americans living in particularly inner cities, urban areas, are not making the same progress in terms of improvement that everyone else is making. They're always left behind in that story.
I should also note that those, if you look at the graph between 1996 and 2016, and this is a graph that is included in this article in the Washington Post, and this is their front page story this morning, and that is that even from 96 to 2016, all of those numbers seem to be very, very horizontal. They don't go up. There's not much up and down. It's fairly steady, but all of those gaps seem to be very much entrenched and very much in place.
Right. One of the things about this economic recovery, that remember when President Obama came in, there was a terrible economic turmoil, and that he had to deal with that, and he did right the ship, the economic ship, and get us back on track, but incomes did not rise, and that's why you see the overall economy stabilizing, you see businesses coming back. But the other thing you saw, and it's in these numbers, is the income inequality. The gap keeps getting wider and wider. And as you say, you have people who are no longer, they're so discouraged, they're no longer looking for work. So what's the forecast now? Well, you see in the first several months of the Trump administration, there's a really troubling sign, which is in the first 7 months, U.S. economy has added about 25,000 fewer jobs per month than it did in the previous 7 months of the Obama administration. So there was improvement in job growth, but that job growth improvement is slowing. And if you layer onto that the proposed budget cuts in education, the cuts in job training, and so on and so forth. Now, as we're moving into a stronger and stronger recovery, you'd think more attention would be paid to the chronically underemployed or unemployed, but in fact, the opposite's going to be true.
The other part of this information that came from the Census Bureau is that the rate of people without health insurance declined. It was small, but it was there, and down
significant.
to 8.8%. But of course, we now expect, since there is little or no effort, all the programs that promote enrollment under the Affordable Care Act are now gone by the wayside. That we expect that those we have 28.1 million people uninsured in this country right now. So what happens to those people, and mm-hmm. how do those numbers reflect in these studies?
Well, I think what you'll see in terms of the Affordable Care Act is while the feds won't put their advertising money behind it, there will be states that will. And the states that support it, like New York, California. I remember being in Connecticut and seeing advertising for there. I think you'll see the
blue states.
The states with and some, I think you'll see Ohio, because John Kasich was not for the gutting of the ACA. He understood. And in West Virginia, and there are some red states that you'll see it. So the states will pick up on the promotion and their health exchanges, because many times you have to go through the state health exchange to get this. If, you know, for the most part, the states that didn't have health exchanges aren't the ones who really wanted the program in the first place. And so while there won't be the millions, if not billions of dollars put in from the feds to promote it, I think we'll see promotion on the state level. And, you know, it works. And people, they just need to get a grip in Washington about the fact that it works. And they have to stop trying to undo President Obama's legacy.
Unlikely.
I know. Legacies, I should say. It is unlikely, I know. But they have more important things to deal with, like not trying to strangle the middle class with their tax cuts.
Go ahead.
There was some really good news last night on the healthcare front. There's a program called the Child Health Plus Program. Mm-hmm. It was enacted in 1997 in the wake of the failed effort for comprehensive health care reform. Senator Kennedy, Senator Hatch came together in a bipartisan way. Then First Lady Hillary Clinton, the three of them working together, said, all right, what, you know we can't get overall health care reform. What can we do? And what they did was pass this Child Health Plus. And it dramatically decreased the number of people who are uninsured from a little over 14% of children were uninsured at the time, and move those numbers down now to about 4%. The problem is that under the Trump administration, this is set to expire, and there had been no effort to try to, you know, efforts were blocking to try to get it reauthorized. But in fact, a bipartisan Senate agreement last night to extend the program not for 2 years, but for 5 years, which is the Trump administration wanted to reduce the program and extend it only for 2 years, but the Republicans in the Senate and the House went against him. As they noted, they negotiated without him and without the Trump administration, and now they've reached agreement, and it looks like at least the Child Health Plus program will survive. It's not a done deal yet, but there seems to be common agreement.
Was that a program born in New York?
Yes.
Well, that was a yes. Pataki program,
yes.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I remember doing work for it very early on, but yes.
Right.
But this is all done with the specter of 2018 looming over these guys.
Right. You know. Well, you know, 8 million to 9 million young children are insured. Now, this is a program where these kids are, their families make too much money to get Medicaid. But they don't have enough resources to get insurance. So at least this appears, again, not a done deal, but it seems that there's House-Senate agreement. The Senate Finance Committee okayed it last night, and it looks like, and they say, well, no, the Trump people were not at the table, but we're going to move it ahead anyway. So one part of one health care, a little glimmer of hope and bipartisanship.
Frankie, what were you going to say? I'm sorry.
No, I was nodding in agreement.
Okay, good.
It's a good program,
you know, Trump promised, so this from the Washington Post article, Trump promised that a combination of tax cuts, infrastructure investment packages, renegotiated trade deals, and the repeal of Obama administration regulations would deliver a burst of job creation and attendant economic growth. So far, no such boom can be found. In Trump's first 7 months, the U.S. economy has added about 25,000 fewer jobs per month than it did during the first 7 months of Barack Obama's presidency. And a more positive sign, the gross domestic product grew at an annual rate of 3% in the second quarter, according to a federal report issued in late August. And while what I'm about to say seems petty, I think it is important, because it's part of the Trump narrative, which is pretty much now taking credit for any jobs that were created from the time that he became a nominee. From June or July on.
I think he's going to take credit from the time he strolled down the escalator.
So it's no longer. I noted that in the. I think when he was in South Dakota, that it was not. He said these are the numbers of the jobs. But when you look back to when I became the nominee, these are the numbers of jobs. I'm like, okay,
but, doesn't work that way.
Yeah. How does that? That's coincidence, isn't it? Is that what that is called?
but you know, this is a post-truth presidency.
Right.
I mean, that's
it's
the problem.
Lying.
Is he just says it? Says these things over and over, and you know, just like touts his job growth, but you know, then there's a fact check that puts it in perspective, and the reason it's a problem is because if you don't face the fact that the jobs numbers are getting worse, then you're not focusing on a solution. And so, you know, while it may seem petty, you know, some listeners say, oh, you're always attacking him. But you really need to be governing with a set of facts of what's actually going on so that you can have the programs in place you need to address what's going on.
Well, but it's facts.
His alternative facts. Thank you, Kellyanne.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with our panel. Libby Post is here, Frankie Bailey, and Teresa Bourgeois. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. We have Libby Post, Frankie Bailey, and Teresa Bourgeois with us this morning, and we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, and look at that.
Letters.
You
yes,
asked,
we have letters.
We shall receive.
That's right.
We have letters. Dan writes, only those that are in government and education can sit back in their high-back chairs and talk about a recovery. Sick. And they admit that there hasn't been any wage growth. Triple the prices everywhere, keep the wages the same, great recovery, and not one banker in jail for the 2007-2008 scam.
Well, he's right. The recovery, it was important that we had the recovery, but it came without wage growth, and it came with a widening income gap.
And these people don't want wage growth. Not the writers, but the people, the 1%.
And that's why you had economic insecurity. And this is what always puzzled me about the election, that the people, you know, that they didn't, who did they respond to
that's
in terms
right.
of economic
right.
insecurity?
But the other interesting, and then you can read the other
Sorry
letter,
about
but
me.
The other interesting
Thank
stat
you.
That came after this was the 20-80 rule. 20% of the people are making 80% of the income, which is typical, absolutely typical.
Michael writes, while discussing the continued lower wages for minorities, cities, and urban centers were cited as a source of some of the low wage issues. Most major cities in the U.S. are run by Democrats, so why aren't our cities centerpieces that show how things could be under progressive administrations? Anyone want to tackle that?
Well, it's a complex story. It's historical in nature. I mean, when you have work disappearing after World War II, there are people moving to the suburbs, the tax base is going down. Work is disappearing from the cities, it's industries, factories. Businesses move to the suburbs or out of the country or to the Sun Belt. And so they're dealing with a smaller tax base. They're dealing with cities that have been devastated. They're trying to recover, but it's a difficult path, even if they are progressive.
And you saw that sprawl in Houston.
Yeah.
I mean, Houston
mm-hmm.
is a very good example mm-hmm. of you saw that sprawl in their economic incentives mm-hmm. to make it less expensive to go out and sprawl. But over time, there's much higher costs for that sprawl.
Exactly.
Sean writes, the consumer confidence reading is off the chart since Trump became president. Business and work-friendly psychology is in the air. Also something to consider is that 60,000 or 600,000. There's a couple zeros missing here, but I guess it's 600,000 in the DACA category. Compete for the same low-skilled jobs as youthful minorities and those in the lower middle class. Huckabee Sanders said days ago, it's a known fact that there are over 4 million unemployed Americans in the same age group as those that are DACA recipients, that over 950 of those are African Americans in the same age group, over 870,000 unemployed Hispanics in the same age group. Those are large groups of people that are unemployed that could possibly have those jobs.
That is based on the assumption that they would get the jobs. If
right.
the DACA young people were not here, that's not a given. I mean, we haven't seen in the past that you know, that people, minorities, people of color, you know, black and Hispanic, are getting jobs, that they are even receiving the education and training that they need for jobs. So it's pitting, I think, you know, those two groups against each other and saying, if this group were gone, you would be better off, which is always a strategy, divide and conquer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, many of these DACA people are highly skilled, and you're exactly right.
I want to go to this letter as a way of changing the subject, because it is one of the stories on our docket this morning, and that is, you know, the Hillary Clinton book came out yesterday, What Happened? What Happened? That was her campaign memoir.
It's a great title.
Yeah, What Happened? So I'll start this off by saying Lynn wrote, "Now I remember why I held my nose to vote for Clinton in the presidential election. This morning, she goes after Comey that he was responsible for her losing. I'm infuriated that she is making Trump's allegations against Comey look legitimate. The Democrats, and I'm one for 50 years, are made to look whiny and weak." Now, so I understand, maybe I don't understand.
I don't understand.
Because Comey did come after her, right? I mean, that was certainly can be considered a very key issue in the campaign.
Yeah.
Although I did want to get into a larger discussion about the book, because the reviews have been scathing from pretty much every front. Even supporters have said that she does seem to blame pretty much everyone else but herself, and even when she does blame herself, she then eventually turns around to blame somebody else. So I did want to bring it up as an issue. She said in the NPR interview, "I'm done. I'm not running for office anymore. But for those, including Democrats, who would like me to go away, well, they're going to be very sad, because they're going to be disappointed. I'm not going anywhere. I have the experience. I have the insight. I have the scars. And I think give me not only the right, but the responsibility to speak out."
You know, I don't think she should go away. I don't think any woman who has put herself out there the way she has, and battled the sexism and misogyny in politics, should be going away. I think these clarion calls of she should be quiet is just an extension of what happened during the campaign. And women should never be quiet.
And
women
look at the
should
success.
Always speak out.
You just talked about at the beginning of the show of the woman who was inspired
right.
by the outcome to run. I mean, that's one of the, you know, in the horror of it all, that's the shining light.
That's right. In the horror of it all, there are plenty of women running all over the country because
who won.
They were energized and now are going to win. But I mean, this was a primary election, but in November we'll see how many actually take their seats. But women are energized, and Hillary was part of that energy, and she serves as a great role model of what to do under incredible circumstances. She lost, yes. Was she responsible for some of it? The candidate, you know, is always ends up being the fall guy in any campaign, because they're the ones who put themselves out there. But there were other, I mean, just like they said in 1992, there's a vast right-wing conspiracy against the Clintons. There was plenty working against her. And I'm not making excuses, folks.
Well, she said that, I believe, in 96,
right,
but yes.
Right,
yeah.
I'm not making excuses, folks. There was plenty working against her, including our own. You know, there were plenty of Democrats, the Bernie bros, who decided, I can't vote for her. I'll vote for Trump because I'm, you know, it doesn't matter. She's going to win. And look what we've gotten.
Or stayed home.
Yeah. So,
is there an issue? Do you think that given the response to the book, and I don't know that the response to the book would have ever been positive. I think any of these political biographies are never really received all that well. But given the response to the book, which seems to be,
well, it's selling well, and people are lining up to see her. Sorry to interrupt
yeah.
you, but
well,
yeah,
that's true. That's true. But my point being is, do you think that it maybe came too soon? That it's still a little bit too raw for people.
I'm sort of surprised it was able to come this soon. You know, I mean, she must have ghostwriters and people helping her, clearly, but I just thought it was really early. I mean, it's only been...
Well, she says in the early part of the book that she started out as writing sort of an inspirational book of things that meant something. That was sort of what she was already doing. And then as she started to write, she was just like, was vomiting out these sections of what, you know, what went wrong and what happened.
Look,
so
I don't think it, I think any time she would have published this book, people would have reacted negatively to it. So there's, you know, there's no good time for that.
I think she needed to write it now so that she could get all of those emotions out and try to deal with them. For better or worse, the problem is she's dealing with those emotions on the page and people are reading about that. And maybe she hasn't had time yet to process some of the things that happened so that she might have stated it in another way later on if she'd written the book later. But I think it was probably necessary for her at this point.
Well, I...
Go ahead.
This is a little long, but Ezra Klein,
yes.
I thought what he wrote, the Vox in Vox, I thought he wrote something that was really interesting. He said...
I like his work.
It's been sold as a Clinton apology for her 2016 campaign, and that it is. But it's more remarkable for Clinton's extended defense of a political style that has become unfashionable in both the Republican and Democratic parties. Clinton is not a radical or a revolutionary, a disruptor or a socialist, and she's proud of that fact. She's a pragmatist who believes in working with this in the system, in promising roughly what you can deliver and saying how you pay for your plans. I mean, and I thought that's exactly right. She's just sitting down, getting to work kind of a gal. I mean, and again, last night, the Child Health Plus resolution, that was Republicans and Democrats, you know, ignoring all the kerfuffle that's going on around them and sitting down and doing the hard work of governing. And, you know, she still believes in that. And right. That's the question. That's fundamentally how our government works. And are we going to retain that? Are we going to retain people who want to sit around and do the day-to-day hard work of actually putting the plans on paper, getting consensus, getting the work done, not promising rainbows and ponies or whatever, but actually getting stuff done?
It's the difference between an emotional response and a rational response. And clearly in 2016, people responded emotionally.
But you had Trump promising things that just weren't true. His rhetoric meant nothing. And it's happening right now with the tax bill. I know we're going to get that to the... But think about the health care bill. Repeal, replace, repeal, replace.
It's not about... But for them, for the people who voted in Trump, it wasn't about what he promised. It was about his rhetoric on race and immigrants. It was all about race. It was all about unleashing that ugly underbelly that we have in this country.
But he promised them affordable health care. He promised them jobs.
Care. They didn't care, Teresa. They only voted because this man was saying whites needed to be in charge.
But my concern is that it went unchecked in a sense, in that he was allowed to keep saying things that were not true over and over and over again. Free airwaves because... Right. It was good ratings for TV.
And the people didn't care. His people don't care about any of that. They want to feel like they're still going to be in the majority in 20 years. And
well,
not.
No, I think that people are economically stressed and they believed him.
Mm-hmm.
They believed what he said was true. Just like, and I know this will infuriate some of the listeners, but people believed Bernie Sanders when he said free college for everybody. Mm-hmm. And that's just not true.
The one thing, there was a part of this, the NPR interview that Hillary Clinton did, asked if she is able to turn on the news without thinking, what would I do in this situation? She responded with a laugh. No, I do it every single time. Look, I was prepared to be president. I had prepared and worked at it. And I go a little batty when I hear him say, gee, this is really a hard job. Who knew healthcare was this complicated? I did.
We all do.
We all
do.
No, I always am responding and reacting. Sometimes I yell at the TV even. I think that is...
she can join the millions of the rest
that's
of
right.
Us.
A very honest human response.
Yeah.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We do have more letters. We'll get to those. And we'll talk about other topics as well. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have Teresa Bourgeois, Frankie Bailey, and Libby Post with us this morning. And we also have a lot of your letters, so we're going to get to those and have a whole slew of them here, so I'll try to get to as many as we can here before the news break at the top of the hour. Greg writes, President Trump tweeted, with Irma and Harvey devastation, tax cuts and tax reform is needed more than ever before. We are trapped the Trump administration twilight zone in the Trump administration twilight zone, where huge weather phenomenons are an impetus for a debate on tax cuts and reform, but not a debate on climate change.
Well, I just saw the tweet a little while ago. It's stunning. Question, where is their tax plan? Put your tax plan on the table. Even the Republicans Tuesday, in their conferences were saying, where's the plan? Because this is a redo of repeal and replace. It's all rhetoric. Mm-hmm. There's no legislative language. Trump is demanding that everybody support his tax plan. He has no tax plan. And it's absurd in the context of a multi-billion dollar cleanup effort that he should compare mm-hmm. those two.
Yeah.
And it requires twisting your head around to get to what he's trying to say about it. When I first read it, I thought I was reading it wrong. I mean, what does tax reform have to do with the disaster we're facing? And you know, to think that he would go there at this moment is kind of stunning.
Right. And do you think we'll ever, I mean, I hope not. I hope the answer to this is no. But do you think we'll ever stop being stunned?
I think some of us are sort of inured to it because
well I mean you expect it but it's still yeah. but I mean it's still jarring when you see it like
yeah, you can't believe he's so stupid,
shocked but not surprised.
Yeah. There's no shock and awe. It's just shock and shake your head.
It's shock, but but the thing is
I feel like Charlie Rose did during that entire Steve Bannon interview, like, oh, you're just like what.
But he gets away with it. It's Chauncey Gardner, and everyone will assess yeah. it. And is he being strategic? He's going to go to 12 or 13 states, they said. Go. I mean, in the middle of the hurricane, he went to North Dakota and talked about tax cuts. In the middle of this devastation, who can you imagine if Barack Obama did that or if Hillary Clinton? People would go nuts. Well, so you're not paying attention to the problem at hand.
But they know how to be a president. He doesn't.
And in the meantime, I'm sorry, letters. I'm
okay. That's all right.
I was just.
You can say in the meantime.
Did you know that?
Well, somebody was shot out of a cannon this morning.
Yeah, really.
Go ahead.
He doesn't even have the basic government in place. I was reading that NOAA. You know, I'm a big NOAA
yes,
fan.
Yes.
Even before this, because of his freeze, that there aren't enough meteorologists, and there's stress. There's a GAO report about is the weather prediction system at risk because they're not filling these jobs. There's no acting head. There's no head of the Hurricane Center. There are key jobs that he hasn't filled yet.
He wants climate deniers to be the head of the Hurricane Center.
The Interior Department Inspector General yesterday just announced an investigation of the Interior Department because they moved 50 top senior executive service people into jobs just because he wanted to scramble what they were doing because they were working on climate, and they moved them to completely unrelated jobs. He's decimating how government works. Okay, I'll stop.
That's all right. Here we go to some more letters. Don't worry, there's much more that's going to get you more fired up, so get ready. Benji writes, Child Health Care Plus has worked great for our family when our household insurance was very expensive for my wife and myself. Once my child was born, covering her was prohibitively expensive. The New York Health Program was inexpensive and had great coverage. Basically, it saved our butts. My question is, what is the redundancy or overlap between the Affordable Health Care Act and Child Health Care Plus? Does the program render the state program unnecessary?
Well, it was thought when the ACA passed that it would fade, that they would lessen the need for Child Health Plus. But in fact, the coverage in many places is better under Child Health Plus, so people have stuck with that. One of the things that they had to work out in this agreement was that it's supposed to be run as a state federal share, and there'd been less and less of a state share since the ACA passed, and they had to rebalance this in this program. Okay, that's way wonky, but glad to know that it worked for you.
Let's see. We have this one from Jen, who says, the one thing that could really jumpstart the economy is health care for all. I would say everyone in my family has accepted lower paying jobs than we are qualified for, just from modicum of insurance. If my husband and I could break free from this low-paying job, we could be in a whole new standard of living. We could expand our side business, both very lucrative and secure. But with a one-year-old son, we can't give up our low-paying jobs to dedicate the time needed for business startup and be left without insurance. Russell writes, remember, folks, he doesn't say these are facts. They're just things that he says. That's what Trump does. He simply says stuff. And Anita says, just to back up a bit to health care, I'd be interested in hearing the panel's thoughts about Senator Bernie Sanders' plan to introduce a single-payer plan to the Senate today with a surprising amount of support. Personally, I'd like to see a plan to allow, not to force people to buy into Medicare at any age. I would love your thoughts. And I just wanted, before I let you all take a bat to this pinata, I do want to read Rebecca's letter, who says, you can continue to demean those of us who voted for Bernie Sanders, Bernie Bros, etc. Please stop. It's beneath you. Okay. Now answer the other letter about the Bernie Sanders plan for single payer.
Okay. I didn't say Bernie Bros.
I did. I'm so sorry.
That wasn't me. No, don't look at me. I think that at some point...
I think you can take your share of the blame.
No. I didn't say Bernie Bros, but I am very distraught about all those Bernie Sanders people who I talk to, who I listen to, who were so outraged that they could not possibly vote for her, and then here we are today. I'm concerned about the timing on Senator Sanders introducing this bill today, because I think what we need right now, we're in a very difficult time frame around the viability of the ACA, the Obamacare, and we need to be focused on building bipartisan support to shore up that program so more and more people don't lose their health care. And we have just 2 or 3 months to do that. And you have people in the Senate Finance Committee and you have people in the House and the Senate, Republicans and Democrats, trying to behind the scenes carve out an agreement on that. And it's going to be tough to do. And now in the middle of that, you add in this debate about single payer. So I believe over time we need to get to a single payer program. I think you get to it incrementally, not with an overall bill, but I'm really disturbed about the timing. I'm worried that the timing of this introduction will upset the delicate balance needed to save the Affordable Care Act.
Mary writes, these are all on Hillary in the book. Mary writes, I would argue that Hillary has no reason to blame herself. I have known too many competent, successful, brilliant women who have failed to achieve success in their careers for the simple fact that they are not men. That Hillary lost was confirmation for women everywhere that the deck is forever stacked against us. Harleen writes, the country was sick of the Bushes and the Clintons. I voted for Bernie in the primary, and I voted for Hillary in the election. I'm a feminist. Hillary was too much supported by big money and big business. Diane writes, the problem with this book is it's looking backwards. Bernie Sanders said it rightfully on the Colbert Show. We need to move forward and be a progressive party. Anyone on that?
I don't think, you know, we have to know where we've been. We have to know our history. We have to have all different kinds of perspectives and understand what's gone on before in order for us to move forward. So we can't not look back.
Is anyone saying to Katie Turr, don't look back?
Yeah, right.
Is anyone saying to the
NBC reporter who just wrote a report called, or a book called Unbelievable, right?
Right. Yeah. Or how many other people have or will be writing books about the election or every other previous election? People write election books all the time. Does anyone say don't look back? Why?
Bernie's book already came out, by the way.
We have to know where we've been.
Say don't look back when he wrote his?
But, you know, this is basic teaching. This is basic academic lore. You need to know where you've been. You need to know your history in order to figure out where you're going.
Well, I think the interesting thing is that Donald Trump is always looking back. I mean, he's always referring to the election, to his big win. And so you can understand why Hillary and Bernie Sanders would want to get their version, their comments about the election, what went on out there.
I think that there's a group of people out there, women and men, you know, on the left, certainly those on the right, who just don't want to hear from her anymore. And I'm sorry, but you're going to. She has a lot to say, and she's incredibly smart, and she was the right choice for president.
And she's got a lot of work to do. She has done a lot to make this country better, and she will continue to
do a lot
to make this country better. She's brilliant.
So John writes this, says, Hillary should not be quiet. Hillary should, however, stop talking about herself ad nauseum. Try focusing on other people, build them up, and support them in important issues, focusing on how she can make things better. And Mike makes this point. Hillary lost Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania by less than 1% in each state. That put Donald Trump in the White House. All of the factors that Hillary cites did not prevent her from going to those four states. Hillary needs to look in a mirror and take more than 30% of the blame for her loss.
Let's remember, she won the popular vote by over 3 million votes. So there's something there. You know, if we didn't have the Electoral College, she would be president.
And let's also remember that everyone says, well, if only Joe Biden. Well, Joe Biden did go into all of those states on her behalf and couldn't pull the votes either. And shouldn't we be talking about the Russian interference in our election? What this Facebook stuff is just astounding to me.
Right.
And shouldn't we talk about voter suppression? If we don't talk about it now,
right?
You know, they're up in New Hampshire, the Republicans talking, you know, about voter fraud, when in fact that's not the problem. The problem is voter suppression. Shouldn't we all be talking about that?
All right, let's take a break there. When we come back, we will continue. We have many other topics to discuss. Teresa's been teasing it all hour. We got to talk about the tax plan, right?
Yeah.
All kinds of good stuff. So we'll
the Red Sox.
we'll get to those stories and much more. We welcome your comments, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Have about 20 minutes left, and we would like to, maybe 15. let me pose this here, Frankie Bailey and Teresa Bourgeois. Alan is away, and we'll be back next week. And let's go to some more letters, and then we'll move on to some other stories. We'll just do these letters quick. Steve says the Bernie Bro narrative was coined by pro-Clinton journalists during the campaign as a political tactic. Literally millions of women supported Sanders over Clinton during the campaign, and they continue to support him afterwards. A Harvard-Harris study conducted in April showed 58% of women polled across all demographic groups favorably viewed Sanders. So cut it out. The panel is better than this. Jill says an earlier letter writer said if... I got the gist of his or her question correctly. If they are the areas that are suffering the most, why do urban areas largely go Democratic/progressive? That, of course, was paraphrased. My answer to him or her, I think the urban areas would probably be in worse shape if they went Republican. Yeah, everyone is nodding in the room, just for those of you listening to the radio. Okay, Jonathan says, I don't understand the comment that slighted Bernie Sanders' wish to have free college tuition. First, Bernie did not say free education, but he said free public education. We already had virtually free public education in the country. Look it up. All he's saying is that since we had this at one time before, why not have it again? Bernie isn't talking about ponies. He's talking about achievable results. Hillary simply dismissed all of these very achievable goals.
Well, I would argue if you look at legislative records, the thing about Hillary Clinton is that, in fact, one thing she was touted for when she became a U.S. senator
is
that she quietly went to work and got results. She got legislation passed. She built coalitions and, in fact, has a very strong track record of getting actual results. Bills passed, programs implemented.
We got two letters left. One from James, who says Trump is as normal, as pragmatic as the government is running pretty smoothly, despite all the petty nitpicking of critics like you guys. And Jay writes, it is great to see so many smart, capable, passionate women running and getting elected. I think it would be fantastic if Teresa ran and Libby managed her campaign. Just saying. So you two kids start working on that, okay?
There you go.
You got work to do.
Either one of us wants to run for office, so
All right. Let's go to the city of Baltimore. Baltimore officers will face no federal charges in the death of Freddie Gray. This announced yesterday afternoon. 6 Baltimore police officers will face no federal charges in the death of the 25-year-old black man who died of a severe spinal cord injury while in custody, according to the Justice Department. After an extensive review of this tragic event conducted by career prosecutors and investigators, the Justice Department concluded that the evidence is insufficient. The department said in a statement, adding that it was unable to prove the officers willfully violated Gray's civil rights. The closure of the criminal civil rights investigation into Mr. Gray's death, which prompted unrest in Baltimore, a predominantly black city, and a federal examination of its police department practices, means that no officers will be held criminally responsible in his death. I know, Frankie, I think at the time we talked to you about the situation. What do you make of this latest development?
Well, it's a high bar, as everyone writes, for federal prosecution. But at the same time, you have a man who's dead. You have other people who have been killed and no accountability in terms of the requirement that someone be prosecuted and convicted, or at least no success in prosecution and conviction. I think in Baltimore, one of the problems was the charges, that people were concerned about the murder charges, the manslaughter charges. And the difficulty, I think, aside from everything else, is what this does, not just to the people of Baltimore, but to everyone in terms of the psychological damage to people who have seen this happen again and again, both blacks and whites, and other people who are concerned about this. There's the economic damage to Baltimore, which is something that we haven't thought a lot about, but the economic damage in the wake of the riots and people leaving the city and businesses that are not coming there, and Baltimore struggling to get on its feet and to make progress, and that too has a devastating effect on communities. And I think for the police themselves, there's the issue of trust. Someone said, I think it was at the time when it was happening, the bond of trust has been broken between police officers. This is not, and the communities that they serve, it's not a new thing, but it's an ongoing thing, a reopening of old wounds, and this has been happening since Ferguson. Ongoing discussion about this, but no resolutions that seem to actually serve communities across the country in terms of dealing with this. I think the consent decree is one way of getting at that. But
meaning, so just go a little bit into that. What meaning?
Yeah, the DOJ report looking at this, people writing about what the deal. For example, Cincinnati and some other cities that have been under consent decrees, where the Department of Justice comes in and there's a threat of a lawsuit, and then there's negotiation, and then the city is put under monitoring to change its pattern or practice in terms of what they're doing. And that has shown some success because it directs the city towards reforms. But it doesn't have an immediate impact. It's a long road to rebuild that trust, but it's one way of getting into getting the city focused on making changes, on reforms.
Can I ask,
yes.
Are there any cities that you can think of where they have put in reforms, where there has been a stronger police-community relationship?
Cincinnati's been held up as a model. They've been dealing with this since 1990. I think they're over 15 years into making those reforms. And they've been mentioned as a model for Ferguson and Cleveland and other cities.
You know, what's so interesting about this is that Jeff Sessions doesn't
approve
value
of consent decrees.
Consent decrees. He's like, we got to let the cops do whatever they want. Fight crime. So,
but for us in, let's say, anywhere outside of Baltimore, anywhere outside of the cities where these cases have taken place, we look at it and say, okay, so at the end of the day, pretty much everybody has gotten away with this without, not to say that they shouldn't have, but the facts still stand that no one has faced any criminal time for these actions, mm-hmm. Right?
I think that's the bitter pill for people looking at these cases as a whole. They're so, relatively speaking, there have been many of these, or at least in terms of what we're seeing with the very high-profile cases. I should say, as a criminal justice person, I need to say they're not typical in terms of people being killed, but the fact that there seems to be a number of these happening in a row, and the media coverage, and the people nationwide, you know, seeing this, even though people are not being killed, people in the community are aware of ongoing harassment, and that's one of the things the DOJ report talked about with Baltimore, this harassment, discretionary arrests, people being arrested and no charges being brought. I think over 11,000 cases of that over a period of time that they were looking at 5.5 years. So it's, you know, people in the communities are aware of this problem, and this, when a death does occur, is like, this is the continuum that they're looking at of things that are going on.
It's and it's also, I mean, the Baltimore case is interesting because you so often the narrative has been the white cop and the black either
defendant,
defendant, but also victim.
Right.
I mean, many of the cases, if they have died in the case, but this was more nuanced because you had three officers of color, you had three white officers,
including a woman.
Yes. So it's an interesting case. I have a couple of letters. We'll get to those in a second. Also want to make mention of Edith Windsor passing. Same-sex marriage basically led that fight to the landmark ruling. She died yesterday at 88. She led that case all the way to the Supreme Court to grant same-sex marriage couples federal recognition for the first time. And her wife, Judith, confirmed the death yesterday. They were married finally in 2016.
Yeah, but she was married to a woman for engaged for over 40 years.
Yes.
Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Her partner who died, she had MS, and Edie went to the government wanting the benefits, and she was denied those benefits that every straight couple would get who were married. And it was interesting because that wasn't necessarily the case that everybody rallied around at first, because it was so specific to just those benefits and specific to the federal government. But it was really the case that made the difference, because once the Supreme Court said that we were entitled to those benefits, there's no way they can say, but you're not entitled to not get married. So she really was a trailblazer, and she lived life to the fullest. And her memory is a blessing for each and every one of us, not only in the gay community, but throughout the country, because of what she did. She stood up at 80 to make a difference.
Gay rights activists acknowledge that the I just want to get this right. Oh, never mind. I thought I had President Obama's tweet.
Yeah, he tweeted out.
He tweeted out, I thought I had it here, but I don't have it.
Right.
Oh, he said, "I had the privilege to speak with Edie a few days ago and to tell her one more time what a difference she made to this country we love."
Yeah.
That was what
I
was looking for.
And what was on their refrigerator always was, "Don't postpone joy." That was the sign on their fridge.
Claire writes to us and says, "Teresa notes the lack of legislation for repeal and replace and now tax reform. I'm not sure about Trump's early career, but for the last 10 years, he's basically spent his time waiting for an executive producer to tell him who to fire. Who are his executive producers now? Surely not Ryan, surely not McConnell, who've spent the last 8 years not legislating, but honing their obstruction skills. The fact this gang can't get anything done is no surprise at all."
Well, that's true. And this is one place where the Trump administration, Mnuchin and others, have said that they're going to have a bill. You know, they were going to have a bill in February, and then they were going to have a bill in March, and then April, May, June. Now it's September,
sort of,
and they still don't have a bill.
It's like this health care.
Right. It's just like repeal and replace. It's all rhetoric, no content. And the question is, you know, Trump had dinner last night with three or four Democrats and, you know, ostensibly wooing them, and he's going around the country. But at some point, Democrats in the media and all of us have to hold them accountable. So what is your plan? You're saying everybody needs to vote for this. Put it on the table, Trump administration. Send up a bill to the Congress. Let everybody look at it. Let's have hearings on it. And let's see what's there. Now, on an unrelated matter, there is a bill that Congress passed last night, a joint resolution. I don't know if anyone noticed this or not, but on the condemning white supremacists and committing his administration to provide resources to combat domestic terrorism by neo-Nazis and other racist groups.
And the White House is
And so that's
balking.
A very interesting thing. So this, to me, where the Republicans in the House and Senate would back this bill, pass it on a voice vote, and then they would openly say that they want to, I'm mixing apples and oranges here, but it's a process thing where the Republicans openly saying, all right, Trump administration, don't ask us to get behind the tax bill until you give us an actual tax bill. Let's put something on the table.
And what's interesting with this joint resolution is now Fox is going after the Southern Poverty Law Center. They're really starting to attack. And if he gets all of his news from Fox and they're attacking the law center, and the law center is the premier organization fighting and exposing all the racism and homophobia and all the hate groups in this country, it's no doubt, no question why they're not. And look, you've got people in that administration like Jeff Sessions who don't want to fight the racism. They want the racism.
But this originated with a Republican from Charlottesville, a congressman from Charlottesville originated this joint resolution, and they could have done a sense of the Senate, sense of the House, which would have never gone to the White House. But they specifically chose a joint resolution.
We're out of time.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, you're all right. That's
2018, fine. That's all I have to say.
Okay. Let me pose Frankie Bailey and Teresa Bourgeois. Thank you very much for being with us. You guys are great. Thank you. Appreciate it. Very nice to have you all here.